TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Naomi Klein, No is Not Enough. Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Naomi Klein says that a corporate political takeover got Donald Trump elected, and now an unprecedented number of people are becoming engaged in movements and politics. She writes that the current rise in activism can resist his policies. However, saying no is not enough. In this talk, she explains that we have the opportunity to build a different economy and a different relationship between humans and the natural world and between each other in community. Naomi Klein wants us to move forward to what she defines as the most pressing question. How do we win deep political transformation so that the kind of living models that communities are already forging can spread at the velocity that is required to keep us all safe? Naomi Klein is internationally famous for having written several major books, among them This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate in 2014, The Shock Doctrine in 2007, and No Logo in 2000. Her most recent book, No Is Not Enough, is coming out in June 2017. The award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, filmmaker, and author was the keynote speaker at the Living Future Conference in Seattle, Washington on March 19, 2017. Living Future is a forum for the green building movement. The ideals that they hold dear are how to build communities that are socially just, culturally rich, and ecologically restorative. Here is Naomi Klein.
It's really nice, actually, to be speaking to you near the end, after you have already heard from so many exciting speakers who have done so much to name the challenges ahead. And I'm able also to take it as a given that you understand the urgency of the need to build a very, very different kind of economy. If you didn't understand that, you wouldn't be engaged in the work that you're doing to try to forge a different relationship between humans and the natural world, and between each other in community relationships of reciprocity, regeneration, and renewal. You wouldn't be trying to restore the natural world to health or to build regenerative communities, and you're doing all that already, and I thank you for that, and it means that I can also skip the usual apocalyptic portion of my presentations where I prove that climate change is happening, that it is very, very scary and dangerous, and we're basically out of time. We will just move forward to the most pressing question, which is, how do we win deep political transformation so that the kinds of living models that you are all forging in your work, in your communities, can spread at the velocity that is required to keep us all safe? You know, I don't like this phrase we sometimes hear, how do we take it to scale? Because I don't think it necessarily has to be big. But I do think we have to do a lot of small and medium size very, very quickly, right? And we don't do that without policy, without real political change. And so when I look at the equation on the podium in front of me, the genius is there, it's in this room, right? So the challenge has, for a very long time, has not been about whether or not it is possible technically to do this. It's often presented as that kind of challenge, right? Well, the technology isn't there, and so on, right? Well, it is there, right? And we know this. We know from fantastic researchers like Mark Jacobson at Stanford University that with existing technology, we can get to 100% renewables for the entire economy well before mid-century, which is what we need to do if we're going to keep temperatures below 1.5 to 2 degrees, which is what we said we were going to do in Paris, right? So the problem is not lack of genius. I don't think it is lack of courage, although there are issues around courage. But I agree that it is more about unleashing the latent courage, creating opportunities to express that. But I think there is another piece of this equation, which is about power, which is about how do we build political power? Because we are up against forces that are actively trying to stop us, right? And often when we talk about sustainability and regenerative economies, we forget about the power equation. How do we build movements that can win? Okay? So I want to focus on that a little bit. And I was thinking about it recently because I was in Santa Barbara at a conference that was celebrating women in the environment, and it was celebrating the particular role that Santa Barbara played in launching the modern environmental movement. So they were talking about how the very first Earth Day was ground zero of Santa Barbara in 1970. And that Earth Day, which, you know, you all know this history, you know, millions of people participated in these teach-ins and demonstrations across the country. It was this awakening. And that led to a series of breakthroughs in legislation that really formed the backbone for environmental law in this country, right? The meaningful strengthening of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and it happened very, 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 very quickly in rapid staccato succession in the early 1970s, which is an important reminder, I think, sometimes when we feel overwhelmed by how much change needs to happen and how quickly, is that when it does start happening, it often happens in this way, like a dam breaking, and then suddenly things start changing all at once, right? You know, it reminds me of the Nelson Mandela quote, you know, it always seems impossible until it's done, right? And so I was thinking about that, and, you know, and frankly, I think the idea that Santa Barbara launched the environmental movement is slightly problematic, and I told them so. You know, I think we should probably backdate it to the earliest indigenous resistance to colonial land grabbing. But just, you know, for the sake of argument, let's say Santa Barbara did it, or did something very important along the way. And if we look at the ingredients for what produced that moment, right? It wasn't they had a big protest and won a bunch of laws, right? There was something else that happened a little bit earlier, and that has to do with the role of crisis and the role of shock, right? Because 1 year before Earth Day was the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill, right? For the younger people in this audience who don't know this history, this was an incredibly shocking event, right? Oil drilling off the coast of California was already controversial, and then there was what at the time was the largest oil spill in American history. Thousands of birds were killed. There were these harrowing images of seals and sea lions and otters absolutely coated in oil, these beautiful beaches covered in oil, cliffs covered in oil. And the record for the world's largest oil spill has since been surpassed. First by the Exxon Valdez, then by the Deepwater Horizon. But it was intensely shocking, and there was this response, right? Earth Day the next year, this staccato legislation. And that's the way the story is often told, right? Crisis, reaction, legislation, right? The sort of frog in boiling water theory, right? We were shocked, we jumped, right? But that leaves out what I think is a very important ingredient in what actually produces deep political change in a culture. And that was what was happening before the shock, right? So think about the timing of this. It's 1969. It is the end of this decade of revolutionary thought on so many different fronts, right? Whether it's the counterculture, whether it's the civil rights movements, whether around the world it is the rise of anti-colonial movements, rising up, overthrowing colonial powers, overthrowing dictatorship. Revolution is in the air. Everything is on the table. People are dreaming in public. Most notably, Martin Luther King about a vision of radical equality and inclusion. But also the counterculture is putting everything on the table, questioning everything about industrial society, from the nuclear family to the suburbs, to the equation of happiness with consumer bubbles, right? And this eventually led to the limits of growth and questioning the role of growth at the center of a capitalist economy. And within the environmental context, earlier in the decade, 1962, you had the publication of Silent Spring, which was a deep challenge to a previous era of environmental writing and thinking, because Rachel Carson was not talking about the need to sort of save particular green museums, green spaces in which to recreate, but really she was challenging this fundamental relationship of humans as conquerors of nature, right? As dominators of nature. The whole idea, she called them the control men, who imagined, in her mind, with such profound ignorance, that they could control the natural world with the use of these military tools that had been honed in the Second World War, right? And apply them to the natural world to try to get rid of insects, and not realizing the rebound effects that would unleash. So it was really about a paradigm shift, right? Really about challenging what is the role of humans in the natural world. And you know, you could see it as a demotion, you could see it as a promotion, right? That we have to understand that we live in community with one another and with all living beings, and in relationships of reciprocity with the systems upon all life depends. So all of this is happening in the 60s, and then the spill pierces it, right? And the spill is held up as the ultimate evidence, as exhibit A, of the madness of this system that would sacrifice all of this life, all of this beauty, just for short-term profits, right? So that is why the shock was able to be metabolized in this way. You know, and I remember when I was covering the Deepwater Horizon disaster, talking to oceanographers who were so frustrated that spill wasn't producing anything. They were saying, you know, the Santa Barbara oil spill got us the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. What is this going to get us? You know, better, you know, a little bit of better technology on oil rigs. That seems to be the only legacy. So why is that? And I think a big part of it was that in the 60s, there was this presence of dreaming in public, of really pushing the envelope. And it is worth remembering that the president who passed so many of these laws, or under whom so many of these laws were passed, was not that good a guy. It was Richard Nixon, a name that's been in the news lately as our pundits search for any kind of precedent for what we're seeing in the White House. And the truth is that Nixon, though he shared a fair bit in common with Trump, his duplicity, paranoia, obstruction, the truth is he passed more and better environmental legislation than Obama. And that is not because he was a better guy. I think it confirms what the great late people's historian Howard Zinn once wrote, that it is less about who is sitting in the White House than who is sitting in the streets, in the cafeterias, in the halls of government, in the factories, who is protesting, who is occupying offices and demonstrating. Those are the things that determine what happens, as Howard wrote. So the political mood in the 60s and early 70s was so radical, in fact, so transformational, revolution was in the air, that these laws that Richard Nixon passed were seen as a compromise, because the demand for challenging the fundamentals of the economic system, those were on the table, right? So these were moderate reforms in that context, because the center had been moved. So let's review these ingredients that produced such interesting change. You had a period of upheaval, unapologetic utopian thought. It's punctuated, pierced by a painful shock, which is held up as exhibit A. And you had the existence of a movement before the shock comes that was already questioning everything. And in this volatile, indeed revolutionary context, meaningful reforms are offered as a compromise. So I offer this as a kind of a formula that we can think about as we try to hold on to some hope that it might not be too late. Okay, but It shows how heavy a lift it is, but it also shows that it's possible. And I think if we look at American history, we see that in those moments of staccato change, a staccato progressive transformation, these factors have been there. Most notably, in the aftermath of the great market crash of 1929, right? Where so much of the progressive infrastructure of this country, public housing, social security, unemployment insurance, electrification, the legacy of the New Deal, regulation of the banks, so much was won in the aftermath of the greatest crisis that capitalism has ever experienced, the crash of 1929. But what was the context for that? Well, it was a context in which revolution once again was in the air. You had a working class that was talking about socialism, that was reading Marx, that was familiar with the vision of W.E.B. Du Bois and of a united interracial working class movement, that was questioning the role of work in our lives. I mean, this is what I find most interesting looking back at the labor movement of the 1920s and 30s. You know, today the labor movement is all about asking for jobs, right? But in this era, much of the labor movement was about asking for leisure, asking for less work, right? The right to a good life, a good quality of life. And it was really about that essential question of what is a good life? What is happiness? What does every human being have a right to? So that was the context in which the crash came, is held up as evidence of the barbarism of the system, right? That we could gamble all of our futures on this casino that could crash so spectacularly that you would have stockbrokers jumping out of windows and millions of people losing their homes and their farms and tent cities and Central Park and so on. There was then a wave of revolutionary and disruptive organizing in the 1930s, a general strike in Minneapolis, an 83-day shutdown of the West Coast by longshore workers, the Flint sit-down strikes, radical demands. The muckraking journalist Upton Sinclair ran for governor of California in this period, and you know, he was kind of the Bernie Sanders of his day, this unlikely populist candidate. And the centerpiece of his campaign was the New Deal isn't going far enough. We should give workers the means of production so that they can turn their factories into workers' cooperatives. And he got almost a million votes in California. He was moving the center. And it was this context that allowed FDR to sell the New Deal as a compromise because the alternative looked that scary to the elites, right? So I think we have to understand these dynamics or what really produces political change. Because I think for so long, the environmental movement has been under this very misguided illusion that if we just scare people, educate people, create an understanding of the depth of this crisis, they will wake up and be like that frog in boiling water and jump, right? And that's an incredibly ahistorical version of how change happens, right? And I often get pushback by my friends in the environmental movement when I write books with capitalism in the title, right? They're like, well, you're making it harder. Why are you making this about capitalism? It's just about carbon. And first of all, you know, I don't think we can separate carbon from capitalism. This is I don't think it's a coincidence that the commercial steam engine and the wealth of nations came out in the same year, not to mention the founding of this country. It was a very action-packed year. This history is entirely intertwined. But more to the point, I don't think I'm making it harder by talking about radical ideas, by putting radical ideas on the table. I think I'm making it easier because I think this is how change happens when radical ideas are in the air. The other thing that I think is useful about, you know, in terms of particularly the 1930s as a model, is though the kinds of change that were introduced in that era are not the kinds of change that you guys are working towards. I mean, these were big centralized state solutions for the most part, right? And you know, a lot of it was fossil fuel based in terms of the electrification and damming of rivers and so on. The velocity of it is of the order that we need right now, right? And the only other analogy that we can reach towards that proves that it is possible for humans to act as quickly as we need to act in the face of this crisis is the way this economy was transformed during the Second World War. Also not the kinds of changes that we want. We don't want our factories to stop making cars and start making fighter jets. We want them to maybe stop making cars and start making public transit, start making wind turbines. But it is possible for this kind of change to happen if we understand the dynamics. So shocks no longer have this kind of wake-up call function, right? And this is what I documented in the shock doctrine, is that it's actually the opposite. And what I found when I was researching the shock doctrine, and you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with that work, what the shock doctrine is a phrase that I came up with to describe this strategy that was developed by the right in the 1970s to use periods of crisis and the disorientation that follows a large-scale shock in a society to push through very unpopular so-called reforms. Okay, I quote Milton Friedman saying, only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. Our job is to keep the ideas ready until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. And this is, in the examples that I use, is incredibly anti-democratic. So, for instance, New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina should have been a wake-up call for our side, right? It should have been a wake-up call because here you have this crisis born of a collision between heavy weather of the kind we're going to see more and more of because of climate change. When you warm oceans, you have more ferocious storms, turned into a catastrophe because the storm slams into weak and neglected public infrastructure. The levees should have held. They did not hold because there had been warning after warning and the Army Corps had not repaired the levees, right? FEMA couldn't find New Orleans for 5 days. You had complete dysfunction. This is the legacy of neoliberalism, right? You neglect the public sphere for 4 decades. You cut it back, and lo and behold, it cannot deal with a crisis of this magnitude. And layered on top of all of that is systemic racism. And so the people who are abandoned on their rooftops in the Superdome are then animalized and vilified on television for going and getting the food and water that they need, right? And vigilantes come into the city. And I was in New Orleans in this period, and black people were being hunted and being shot by police, by vigilantes, who were afraid that they were going to somehow escape the city and go to the suburbs. And it was just like so sci-fi. It was the vision of the future we've imagined so many times in every sci-fi film. I often say that our greatest challenge is not to reimagine that future of a little bubbles of fortress winners surrounded by hordes of locked out losers, which is essentially the plot of every sci-fi movie you're ever going to see, but imagine a different kind of future where we come together across divides in periods of crisis and believe that we can do that in our bones. So that, I think, is our task, is to tell a different kind of story. And I think the reason, you know, we've had these moments where, which should have been wake-up calls, Katrina, the 2008 financial crisis, right, which was so clearly the result of, getting rid of the laws that were passed in the aftermath of the great crash of 1929, like Glass-Steagall's, deregulating the financial markets, just letting these bubbles inflate, allowing these outrageous profits to be made, and then the bill for it gets passed on to regular people who were the most victimized by the crisis, who were losing their homes. They get victimized through more cutbacks to pay for the trillions of dollars in bailout. So this should have been a wake-up call, and indeed it was a kind of a wake-up call. Around the world, you had a wave of organizing, protesting, occupations. In this country, it was called Occupy Wall Street. In Southern Europe, they called it the movement of the squares because central squares in Greece and Spain and Portugal were being occupied for months on end. It was the increase in food prices that set off the Arab Spring in the same period. So all around the world, people were saying no. We do not want this. And there was a slogan, we will not pay for your crisis, that ricocheted around the world. But somehow it wasn't enough. And the reason it wasn't enough, and the reason I called my new book No Is Not Enough, is because what is clear from this is that just saying no, that is a bad idea, while it may slow down or hold back the worst of the attacks, it is not going to get us where we need to go. We need a convincing, inspiring yes that is a vision of the future that will keep us safe. You know, and the reason we haven't had that is not because, you know, we're bad people. It is because I would argue that we are products of our time, and that we need to understand the flip side of the neoliberal project that began in this country under Reagan and in the UK under Thatcher and then was globalized around the world as not just a project that was advancing a set of economic policies, market fundamentalism, privatization, deregulation, low taxes offset with cuts to government spending. Flip side of that in this country was mass criminalization of communities of color and mass incarceration. It's not just that. It is also a war on the imagination. That was always central to the neoliberal project, was saying there is no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher said, that there is nothing but this. Any idea you could possibly have about another way that we could live is inherently wrong and suspect, right? So we now have generations that have grown up without the muscle of imagining other possible futures and without those examples. And this is why the work that you're doing is so important in terms of dispelling the idea that there is only one way to live, only one way to build, only one way to interact with each other. And there are many examples of this, growing examples of this, of proving to people through action, because you're not going to prove it to them just by saying it. You're going to prove it by feeling it, by living it, by seeing it, by touching it. So the good news is that we're starting to see a revival of the utopian imagination.
That was part one of a one-hour talk, No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need by Naomi Klein. She's the Canadian journalist, syndicated columnist, filmmaker, and author. When she gave the talk you just heard, her most recent book, No is Not Enough, was not finished yet. The release date is June 13, 2017. Naomi Klein was the keynote speaker at the Living Future Conference in Seattle, Washington, on March 19, 2017. Thanks to Mike McCormick for the recording. Come back for the conclusion of No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.